Good evening. Welcome to the Better Health Radio Show.
Peace be unto you, to your distinguished guests, the staff, to Greg, and thank you very much, Dr. Boyce.
Yes, hello? Please.
Thank you.
Yes, she can hear you.
Hello, you can hear me?
Yes, she can. Go ahead, please.
Yeah. Thank you for enlightening us each Sunday with your kindness and humanitarianness. I just want to say thank you. My relatives truly appreciate you, and they'll be back. And thank you not only for being a doctor, but a counselor also. And they appreciate you very, very, very much. I haven't met you, but I hope next time I'll be able to come along to see you. But I thank you very much. I pray God protection, guidance, blessings, that he grant you wisdom, and always have a kind heart to others. So thank you very much, ma'am. And continue to keep the good work up. Continue to enlighten us in trying to keep ourselves healthy, and to give us the knowledge that if we see anything that we are not accustomed to, we should go to the doctor. I heard you spoke about Oprah. Well, I tell you, if Oprah had appreciated good work, or from the time I started until I finished, it was pain. At one time, I had to stay home 7 days. Every month. So, good luck to Oprah. Yes. Anyhow,
sorry.
Have a blessed evening.
Expecting. Yes,
take
Gil.
Care.
Thank you. Thank you for
God
your
bless.
Comments. Thank you so much. Much appreciated. Much appreciated. We are discussing this one last point, John, about the laparoscopic hysterectomy. So, you say to me that these incisions are 1 centimeter.
Yeah, they. The largest one is the umbilicus, which is 1, right? When you're going, yeah? Then you have 2 to 3 other 0.5 centimeter incisions, yeah?
Right.
Right. So if you don't have to convert, then those are all the incisions that you have, right? Because
my question for the patients, right? Because I'm thinking like a patient now. So if my fibroids are bigger than a centimeter, and you have cut a centimeter hole in my abdomen, logic says to me that something that is bigger than a centimeter cannot come through a 1 centimeter hole. How is this fibroid coming out?
Right. If you do myomectomy, yeah, sometimes you can just increase the incision on the lower tummy to a centimeter and a bit, and then you can get all the fibroids out. Yeah. If you're doing a hysterectomy and the womb is big, as in very big, yeah, and remember I said that you cannot do the morcellation. So what we have to do is then take the womb that's taken out through a slightly bigger incision, like a 3 centimeter incision. We can take the womb out through that size of incision. It's just that you gotta remember that the skin is one layer. But the skin can stretch a bit. So what we do is we actually, there's a membrane called the rectus sheath. So we can actually extend that down much further than the 3 centimeters to then get everything out. Yeah?
Good. So you see, that's the better picture now, because, you know, mathematically, there are people with this straight, you know, logic.
I know.
You know, this is not making any sense. So we are going to switch lanes now from the structural problems to the bleeding problems as a result of hormonal imbalances, and talk a little bit about dysfunctional uterine bleeding and what makes that definition, what causes dysfunctional uterine bleeding.
Yeah, it's mainly hormonal. So essentially, estrogen and progesterone is what causes the lining of the womb to get thicker and thinner. So sometimes if you have variations in this, like, say if you have like PCOS, you have a hormonal imbalance. So you can get either no periods, or sometimes you can get heavy irregular periods. And that's one aspect of the hormonal issues. The true DUB would be just the lining of the womb just increases and sheds. The only problem with the dysfunctional uterine bleeding is that because it's hormonal, only hormones can be used to control it in the younger population. So that means either going on the pill are going on the Mirena coil. So the Mirena coil is essentially like a copper tea. But instead of having copper, there's a medicated progesterone called levonorgestrel, which is released to thin the lining of the womb. The only issue with progesterones, like the Mirena coil or like S-Luton or Cerazet, is that if you're lucky, you get no bleeding at all. Sometimes you can get like irregular spotting, or sometimes you can get heavy bleeding. Now, as a matter of point, which I have to tell patients, which I tell patients all the time, if you listen to a patient in which the Mirena coil did not work, and she gets to you before me, you will never put it in. But you have to remember that this subset of patients is only 2% in which you don't get no benefit from it. So that's why you say if you put in a Mirena coil, you usually have to wait 6 to 9 months to see the actual true benefit. Some people are lucky, but it ain't no bleeding at all. Some people might just have light spotting and then that settles. And then some might just have a markedly reduced period at the time of the menses. Sometimes it takes a bit longer to work, but then sometimes it don't work at all. And that is about 2 to 3%. But if this subset of patients gets to you first, you will not take it.
Okay, so one of the things that we have to clear up for our listeners would be PCOS. Remember that I had mentioned one of our guests that we had a little while ago, and she had endometriosis, and we spoke about the Foundation Barbados Association of Endometriosis and PCOS. Yeah. I might be calling it wrong, but for those who don't know, PCOS is polycystic ovarian syndrome, and we would have had a show on this before where there are several cysts in the ovary, more than normal, and there's some other clinical features that make up this syndrome. And we had mentioned a little earlier about dysfunctional uterine bleeding, because sometimes, you know, we revert as physicians to using the terms, but remembering for our listeners, DUB is dysfunctional uterine bleeding, which is a topic that we're on now, discussing heavy menstrual bleeding.
Mm-hmm.
You made a very valid point, which for me as a general practitioner, family physician, is one of the most frustrating things ever, where some people refuse to get routine screens because of other person's experiences. For example, a 50-something year old lady who refuses to get a mammogram because her son, who is not likely to get breast cancer, says that he does not want her to be exposed to radiation. Or another person might say that they had a mammogram and it was painful. My response to that is, so you know that that person has had their mammogram though.
Correct. Not, correct.
They had theirs. And you are sitting down there using somebody else's experience, not getting your own screening test as warranted.
Correct.
I would feel a little more justified if you went and you had a painful experience and said, okay, I'm not going back. I can understand that a little bit more, but not based on somebody else's experience. That being said, it is up to you as the individual. We as doctors, we are not there to hit you over the head and make you do anything. Our role is to guide and direct, inform and assist, not force. We are not in the business of forcing persons to do things at all. So yes, so we veer back onto our track of dysfunctional uterine bleeding, where we've heard that hormones are responsible for these abnormal bleeds that the ladies might have.
Mm-hmm.
I just got a little signal there. Yes, Greg, didn't hold
me. Somebody wants to ask you and the good doctor a question. Before we get on to another topic, let me just squeeze this one in here very quickly. Good evening. What is the difference between polyps and cysts?
Okay. Now, when you talk about you got endometrial polyps, which are soft, fleshy bits of tissue inside the womb, right? So these can be identified on ultrasound. And if you have any ultrasound evidence of polyps on any aged person, then the gold standard would be to do a diagnostic hysteroscopy, whereby you put a small camera in the womb, and this is preferably done as an outpatient. In relation to also scanning as well too, the scan would also to pick up, when you talk about cysts, I presume she means ovarian cysts. However, when we look at the lining of the womb, when we magnify it, we look to see if it's a solid stripe or if it has encystic areas in it, meaning that fluid-filled areas in the actual lining of the womb. For argument's sake, if we scan a postmenopausal lady and we see this, then we think of something called endometrial hyperplasia, which is a pre-malignant condition. So the same management would be for that group, which would be putting the camera in. If, however, the patient has an ovarian cyst, which is a cyst on the actual ovary itself, sometimes you can get cysts on the fallopian tubes, which are called fimbrial cysts, but the major cyst would be a simple cyst, which is just like a balloon of water in it. Sometimes the cyst can be very complex, meaning that the best analogy I think would be like a honeycomb, the different circles and stuff in it, so you can get like solid and cystic spaces in the actual cyst itself. So those would be very bad cysts or malignant cysts. Or sometimes you can get cysts which are formed from endometriosis. So these are not like simple cysts, which is just like when we look on the ultrasound, you just see a circle as the outline. And then for the fluid, you just see dark, right? You just see just jet black, and you just see a line around the jet black circle. So that's a simple cyst. If you have an endometrioma, which is endometriosis on the ovary forming a cyst, is more like a speckled marble appearance. So you get like the same cyst, but instead of being jet black, you get like these whitish like dots within the actual scan. And the third type of cyst that you can find would be a dermoid, which is one of the most common cysts. And this is formed from the germ cell layers, which is like layers in the skin. So you can get skin in there, you can get teeth, you can get hair, you can get sebum as well. So sometimes that you would take the cyst out and then you see teeth looking at you. So sometimes it's a bit scary.
Yes, I remember. I believe I saw one of those. I think I saw one of those. Never know, but yes. So we understand the difference between cysts and polyps. And again, for our listeners, any concerns that you might have with bleeding, abnormal bleeding, we're discussing abnormal heavy bleeding. We've discussed most of the benign causes. We went into a bit of surgery trying to determine the different ways of which we can take fibroids out, or in those persons who've completed their family and don't wish to have any more children, hysterectomy is an option. And we discussed a little bit about informed consent and how important it is to have that conversation with your doctor. Again, we want to reiterate or just go over again the simple fact that much of what goes on in medicine has to be conversation between physician and the patient and the relatives as well, because relatives are impacted by the illnesses of the individual patients. So we can't leave the relatives out. But relatives have to understand that the final decision, once the patient is competent, must be left up to the primary patient. But that conversation is so important. You can ask any question. It never ceases to amaze me again that a patient would have gone to a particular doctor, had something done, sometimes even had surgical procedures, and they have no clue as to what went on or what the doctor did and said and what the medication was for. It is to your benefit as the patient to ask as many questions as possible. And if the doctor gets upset that you're asking questions, find another doctor. So we've spoken about the benign causes, as it were, because really and truly, heavy bleeding is not a benign thing. When we say benign in this setting, it's the fact that it's not cancerous. But let's talk quickly about the possible malignant causes of heavy vaginal bleeding.
Okay. When one comes to a gynecologist, especially if they're over 45 years, but this is where you get a lot of issues. So most of the cancers don't find for this subset below 45, right? So what we look for is if you have heavy periods, extremely heavy periods, over 45, you have bleeding in between the periods for more than 6 months, right? All these are warning signs. So if you get a patient over 45, bleeding in between the periods, heavy periods, or they're getting irregular periods, or what we call perimenopausal, meaning that they're about to go into the menopause. But what you have to realize is that when the ovaries are failing, the levels of estrogen are very high because they're trying to kickstart the ovaries. So as a result, the lining of the womb becomes abnormal. So you can have what we call endometrial hyperplasia, which is the pre-malignant, and they have simple and complex with atypia. Now, once you get, endometrial hyperplasia is essentially the lining of the womb on steroids. So the lining is very thick and vascular. And sometimes, as I said before, we look for like cystic spaces and stuff. So if you get that on ultrasound, you definitely have to get an endometrial biopsy as a minimum. And essentially what this is a very small thin tube that I place through the neck of the womb to take a biopsy. And this is sent off to the lab. In relation to the gold standard will be putting in a camera to have a look around and then taking, you can do the directed biopsies if you see something abnormal, and then do a general collection of the specimen with the papal biopsy. Now, once we do that, we then send it to the lab. Now we can get the, it can either come back normal, which is fine. Those are the lucky people. If you're not so lucky, then you get endometrial hyperplasia. Now the endometrial hyperplasia, we treat with putting in a Myrina coil, and then what we do is re-biopsy in 6 months time. So this can continue for a year or two to get everything back to normal. If it's hyperplasia with atypia, no, that's a different ball game. You have a 3-5% chance of endometrial cancer. So the treatment then is a hysterectomy. That would be advice. Gold standard would be laparoscopic hysterectomy. If not, then do a normal abdominal hysterectomy. Then the next result on the field is endometrial cancer. So any person over 45 with heavy irregular periods or intermenstrual bleeding, these would be additional risk factors for endometrial cancer. Also too, if you had a history of PCOS, increased body mass index, or diabetes, your risk would be higher than another person. And in terms of treatment, would depend on the grade of cancer it is and how aggressive it is.
So I remember somebody saying that obesity and diabetes were like the cousins that you really didn't want to invite to a family party. Because they just seem to make every condition you have even worse. If you have depression and you're obese, it's worse. If you have hypertension and you have diabetes, that puts you at increased risk for cardiovascular disease, and then you're at risk for heart attacks and strokes. If you have diabetes and kidney disease, it just makes everything worse. And so if you can do what is possible within your power to try to reduce your risk by reducing your weight, every physician says this almost every day. I'm sure if I call any of my colleagues, no, this is probably one of those things that they say nearly every day. We're going to take a call and then we're going to begin our wrap up with Dr. John Barker, who's in this evening discussing heavy menstrual bleeding.
Okay. Good evening. Is the caller there, please?
Yes, good evening.
Yes, could you kindly hold for me 1 second? I've got two queries here and I want to get them out of the way before we leave. We've got you on the line, so stay put, please. Doctor, the person who inquired about the polyps and cysts says, I had 4 polyps removed in December. I was told to go back in June of this year because polyps can grow again. The polyps removed were benign. That's what the person wrote back after you answered the question. And this other comment says, hi, I'm going 65 years and have not been for a pap smear or mammogram since 2011. Can this be dangerous? And then we'll go to the caller.
Right. In relation to the polyps, now, if the polyps were removed and they were benign, it all depends on the age. Huh? So if, for argument's sake, they have any bleeding issues, like if the postmenopausal and started to bleed again, then they need to be reinvestigated. Or if they're below, or if they are not menopausal, if the bleeding has come back, like how it was before, or is more irregular, or you're getting the bleeding in between your periods, then they will need an ultrasound scan first. This is for both premenopausal and postmenopausal women. So if you're symptomatic, then you will need reinvestigation. For the lady from 2011, I would advise her to get screened, because the issue is that if you, for argument's sake, haven't had a smear, pap smear done, and you don't know what's happening 10 years, and usually you might be lucky and there's nothing wrong, but I would advise you to get checked, because sometimes when you're going out to get checked, you might have a condition that we could have picked up 10 years ago. And this is for both the breast and the smear. And you have to remember that in, depending on the population that you're in, the risk of breast cancer is 1 in 10 to 1 in 11. So I would advise you to get screened.
Okay, caller.
Yes.
You're up, please. I beg your pardon, doctor.
Good evening.
Yes, doctor can hear you.
No, go. I was saying I agree.
Okay. Go ahead, caller. The doctor's
no,
here.
I don't want to come across as being facetious. I'm really asking out of ignorance, really. And so I would maybe inform. But a person who is transgender, moving from male to female, will these sort of complications, will they have to worry about things like these? I'm at a loss, so that's why I thought I would ask.
So, Dr. Barker?
No, it's they're moving from...
Right, I was wondering, from male to female or from female to... Well, I guess it's from male to female.
Male to female, yes. Yeah, you know, in terms of the breast growth and some of the organs and so on, impact on the organs.
Oh, no, no. There wouldn't be any risk in terms of, like... well, obviously, they would have male genitalia, which would be converted to... female, but they wouldn't have any uterus or ovaries or tubes, so they wouldn't be at risk for anything gynecological. Because
what about the swelling of the breast or the improvement enlargement of the breast, would that occur? And if so,
would have breast implants and estrogen, so their risk of their risk would not be as much as a woman in terms of 1 in 10. Because remember that if they're transsexual from man to woman, they'd be given estrogen. So they would start getting breasts and then they might put in the breast implant. So there is technically a risk of, but in terms of the risk wouldn't be as great as the 1 in 10, 1 in 11. I mean, I can be subject to correction, but the risk of breast cancer shouldn't be increased.
Thank you so much, and I do enjoy the programs on evenings, I really do.
No problem.
Thank you kindly, sir. Go ahead,
Thank
Dr. Boyce.
That was a very interesting question. That was a very interesting
I would give you this enlightenment. When I was first year registrar in UK, I was in Cheshire. I was at this hospital and I was asked to take some bloods on a female who had a hysterectomy. So when I went into the room, I was shocked because the lady had more beard than me. So, and then the nurse looked at me because there are some things that you cannot hide. So it was my first exposure to such, you get me? So I was shocked, but then it's only afterwards that you become more understanding, because once you understand why somebody would want to do that, then you understand the process. But to the ordinary person listening, they would say, well, why would somebody want to do that? But there are all sorts of psychological stuff going on. But it was shocking for me, because when I went in to get the blood, I was like, whoa. But
yeah, if you could see Dr. Barker's expression, that's why he chuckled, you know, he said, whoa. Yeah, that was a classic look there. So
that was one of my experiences in medicine. Yeah.
You see, and that's why we should never judge. Never, never, never judge.
No. Mm-hmm. Not until you walk the road.
Correct. I agree with you completely. So we have 3 minutes, Dr. Barker, and we have mm-hmm. discussed a myriad of topics as mm-hmm. relates to female bleeding. We've mm-hmm. discussed malignant causes. We've discussed non-malignant causes, so cancer and non-cancer causes. We've discussed mm-hmm. a little bit about surgery. We've discussed some of the treatment options, both mm-hmm. medical and non-medical. What is the one thing that you want persons listening to keep at home? I was about to say take home, but everybody's at home. What's that yeah. one thing you want the listener, but everybody except you? What do you want listeners to keep home with them?
Okay, essentially, heavy bleeding is not normal, so it's painful periods, that's not normal. So essentially, see a gynecologist or a GP, either way, at least you see a medical person. And in relation to patient-informed consent, take what your doctor says, read, come and ask questions. Wherever possible, depending on your lifestyle, then the minimal access techniques would be more amenable to most people to get them back to work. I forgot to mention one of the major innovations would have been uterine endometrial ablation, which is destroying the lining of the womb, which is a 5-minute process in relation to the procedure itself. So there's either balloon ablation or radio frequency ablation, or sometimes you can reset, which is removing the whole lining of the womb, which is another minimally invasive technique to use for that, for heavy bleeding. And it can be used for dysfunctional bleeding, which is the major source in the first world countries, the endometrial ablation. Or sometimes it can be used if you have very small fibroids, less than 3 centimeters. But you have to have that chat with the gynecologist. And as I tell most people, anytime you talk to any person about a technique, they have to ask them if they do the technique. Because if they don't do the technique, then they would not know the specific ins and outs of a particular procedure, so they would not be able to counsel you appropriately. So you must, if you're thinking and you read something, you must ask a question if the person does it or etc. Because what somebody might offer you might be only what they can do in terms of a small subset. So that's what you'll be counseled for versus in relation to other techniques that may be out there. So what I'm saying is that information is king. Make sure you read on your condition, if whatever you have, make sure that you know all your options and go through all your options. And as Rania said, our job is just to facilitate. And if I can't do something, I refer you. I don't hold on to you because I'm no use to you if I can't help you.
Right. I agree. And the one thing that I want our listeners, as I encroach on Cheryl's time, what I want the ladies to remember, and persons in general, is this thing about anemia. One of the consequences of heavy bleeding that we didn't mention it earlier, is the possibility of anemia. Anemia is not a diagnosis, it is a symptom. Which means that you need to find the underlying cause. So somebody who's a young female who has heavy bleeding, well, more than likely her anemia is as a result of the heavy bleeding, losing blood every month and a lot of blood. But a 50-something-year-old man who's losing weight with anemia, that's a completely different picture. The possibility of an underlying stomach cancer or colon cancer. Therefore, if somebody says to you, you have anemia, don't spend 5 years of your life walking around saying, I have anemia. My question is, why?
Why? Correct.
Right? So, you have, Grayson, is there anything that you want to say before
No, you're doing well. You're doing well. So you can go right ahead, please.
Yes.
You've not encroached too far on Cheryl's time.
Yes, and if you keep talking, I'll encroach on it more.
But you solicited my input. Go ahead.
I just wanted a little input.
Okay, I will keep quiet. You go ahead, please.
Yeah, see, still talking. Yes, so you have been listening to the Better Health Radio Show, helping you to live your best life. We are going to be having our psychiatry block coming up a little later on. We're also going to be having fertility medicine, and I believe next week is going to be alternative medicine, one of the branches of alternative medicine. So that should be an interesting show as well. I will claim that all the shows are interesting. I am your host, Dr. Renee Boyce, and I've been chatting with who has become my good friend, Dr. John Barker, over there at Jera B Medical Center. I believe it's 10th Avenue.
Tenth Avenue, yes, please.
10th Avenue, Belleville. So you can look him up, look up Dr. Yarbrough or Dr. Rose on the internet. You can have a chat with them or your general physician if you have any problems. Gredston, as usual, it is a pleasure being with you and looking forward to seeing you next week, Lord willing.
God's willing, we will be here. Thank you kindly for presenting another great program and bringing on a regular, because we can only call him that now because he's been here so often. And we always appreciate the fact that he comes around. Thank you, Dr. John Barker. Huh?
Thank you.
You're welcome. Dr. Thank Boyce, you. Thank you as well. Yeah. Until next week, you have a wonderful week ahead. Take care.
Yes, you too.
All Bye-bye. Right. Thank you both.
Have a nice day. Yeah.
All right. You've been listening to the Better Health Radio Show with a kind, I almost said the kind compliments. Let's just say that we thank the good doctor, Dr. Renee Boyce, for her time, and we thank Dr. Barker for his time as well to come here and educate us all in some areas of medicine.